the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:04 p.m. Try that again. I'd like to call the House Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:04 p.m. on Tuesday, March 12, 2024. We're meeting today in Davis Room 106 of the Capitol Building. Please silence your cell phones out of courtesy to others who are attending. So, committee members in attendance today, we have Representative McCormick, Representative Sadler, Representative Fields, Representative Mina, and myself, Chair Prock. So we have a quorum to do business. And I also want to introduce my committee aide, Riley Nye, in the corner. Please pass any correspondence with the committee through Mr. Nye. And I want to thank our House Records Recorder, Cale Brown, and Zach Lohorn, our teleconference moderator. The items on today's agenda are, we're going to hear from Bradley Cross, governor's appointee to the Board of Optometry. And this will be the third hearing of the governor's bill 275, sexual assault examination kits. And we have four amendments for that bill for our consideration. And the last item is House Bill 298, alcohol warning signs on licensed premises governed or sponsored by Representative Gray. And we'll hear invited testimony on that bill. So first is governor's appointee Bradley Cross to the Board of Optometry. Mr. Cross, please.
Yes.
Call. There we go. Please put yourself on record and explain your qualifications for the Board of Optometry.
Yes, through the chair, this is Dr. Bradley Cross, optometrist. I've been on the State Board of Optometry for the state of Alaska since 2019 and serving as the chair since March 1st of 2022 and been recommended for reappointment and am happy to accept that nomination to be appointed for a second term, four-year term. And been accomplishing some good things with the optometry board and maintaining our annual reports and attending board chair meetings with Sarah Chambers, our board advisor. So be happy to continue in that role and be happy to entertain any questions you might have for me.
Okay, do we have any questions for Mr. Cross from the committee? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, the chair. Dr. Cross, thank you for your willingness to serve again. You said you've been, the board has been active in several areas. If you could give us some more details on what kinds of issues you've been working on with you at the chair at the helm.
Sure. Through the chair, we've passed a regulation project recently that overhauled a few outdated regulations in reference to how people who have federal positions have to be licensed by doing a bunch of extra steps, and we've eliminated some of those to streamline licensing for those folks who may have been serving in the VA system or Indian Health Service. They had extra requirements to report for their application, and we've remedied that. Another big project that was passed was the telehealth regulation that we were put into that bill that was passed by the governor in 2021 and came up with some regulations to better tailor that to the needs of optometry and hopefully to protect the public a little bit from what could happen with telehealth and optometry, which is a kind of a hands-on profession. So we put some extra kind of regulations in there about how we would see that going forward. And that was all passed after quite a bit of back and forth and time spent with the law department to get the language correct. A couple other things that we do annually are our annual reports to the division, including the budget that we have to maintain and propose and maintain. And we are currently working on another legislative project with Representative Ruffridge to just kind of clarify something that's been missing in our statutes. So we've been busy. We've got a lot going on, and we're trying to do that as efficiently as possible, respecting the other board members' time as they're all in busy practices. So.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Cross? Representative Sadler.
If no one else, I do have one other question. Through the chair, Dr. Cross, we just came off of a long floor session today, which in part addressed different boards and professional boards, and the executive branch is pulling back some of the responsibilities back into the executive departments. I guess I would just ask you this question. How would you characterize the level of support you receive from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development as you conduct the work of the optometry board?
Through the chair, I think that my answer to that would be we have had exceptional support through the department. Both our examiner in Juneau and her supervisors have been very quick to answer questions and provide information that we need when we are either in meeting or proposing topics for our meetings. So I'm unaware of what's been going on down there today, so it'd be interesting to find out what that was about. But up to this point, I would say that we've had exceptional support from the division.
Any other? I have a quick one. Did you say you were working on streamlining?
Yes. That was part of what we passed in our last regulation project that went into effect in April, was streamlining the application process for optometrists who are applying for licensure in Alaska who have come from a federal employment position through the VA or IHS. And so we eliminated a lot of extra requirements that those folks had compared to someone who did not have those employment backgrounds. And there is some other language we're going to be working on our next regulation project to just clean up some of the kind of confusing or excessive wording in our regulations. So that's the next project we're going to tackle at our April meeting.
Okay, I just like the sound of the word streamlining. Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I actually also enjoy the word streamlining, and I will say I've actually worked with Dr. Cross in a professional capacity when I have served as board chair for the Board of Pharmacy, and I found him to be incredibly well versed at his job and does actually put in a ton of effort into making sure that his profession is moving forward in this very streamlined capacity. So I would agree with this appointment very strongly, and hopefully you get more streamlining, Representative Prox.
Oh, that'd be great. All right. Thank you, Mr. Cross. And with that, we will hear I will open public testimony on the appointment of Bradley Cross to the Board of Optometry. Do we have anyone in the room that wants to comment on Mr. Cross's appointment? And we do have, looks like, three people online. Oh, one of them is Mr. Cross. Dr. Damian Delzer, are you with us?
Good afternoon, Chairman. This is Damian Delzer of Fairbanks calling. I'm calling in support of the reappointment of Dr. Cross to the Board of Examiners and Optometry. I am the former chair of the Alaska Board of Examiners. I'm also very honored to be the current president-elect of the Alaska Optometric Association. I had the distinct privilege of working with Dr. Cross for a number of years on the board, and he was and is an excellent asset to the profession and to the board. He has devoted countless hours to professional issues that have arisen, and and as was previously mentioned, instrumental in drafting some telemedicine regulations as well as many other regulation projects. And I would just like to recommend him without reservation for reconfirmation. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Damien. Next, we have a Dr. Pamela Conrad from Bethel. Pamela, are you with us?
Yes, and for the record, I'm Dr. Pamela Conrad from Bethel, Alaska. I was calling to voice my support for the reappointment of Dr. Cross. I've had the amazing good fortune of knowing him his entire optometric career, from the time he was in optometry school diapers, because he was my lab partner at the Pennsylvania College of Optometry for 4 years. He has had the board become very agile. They've been able to get things through what he was speaking to about the federal and VA onboarding for providers, especially out here in the bush. It takes us such a long time to get providers. We go sometimes for a year or two waiting till we get people through the paperwork, and that has really, really expedited us being able to get care out here for our patients. So he's a very skilled optometrist, not skilled enough to keep me from getting kicked out of the contact lens modification lab because I kept on shooting the blanks everywhere. But that was not his fault. That was my lack of skill. But I say that in jest. He is an amazing provider, and I think he is great, a great appointee for the board.
Okay, thank you. And I heard the word expediting, and that's a good word to hear. So thank you for your testimony. And do we have anyone else that would like to comment on Bradley Cross's appointment to the Board of Optometry? All right. And with that, public hearing is closed. And too quick?
No. Oh. I just had a comment if I
might. Oh, sure.
I would just like to state.
Representative.
Thank you. Harmick. Through the chair, Dr. Pamela Conrad is my mom.
So you're a little biased. Well, okay. I mean, all right. Very good. All right. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Dr. Cross. And we are fortunate to have many qualified people serving the state on these boards. Thank you for your service.
Thank you again.
And also, I want to let the public know that they can send written testimony by email to the email address is hhss@akleg.gov. All right. Any other comments from the committee? Good. Then the House Health and Social Services Committee has reviewed the qualification of governor's appointee Bradley Cross to the Board of Optometry and sends his nomination to the full legislature for consideration. Signing this report does not reflect any individual's recommendation of approval or disapproval, and we'll take a brief at ease to sign the committee report and get ready for the testimony on House Bill 275. We're back on the record. The next item on the agenda is Governor's House Bill 275, Sexual Assault Examination Kits. And available today to give us a brief reintroduction of the bill and answer any questions is Lisa Purinton, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. Did I get that correct?
Yes, sir.
Good. So, Ms. Purinton, if you could please put yourself on the record and give us a brief reintroduction of House Bill 275.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Rocks. For the record, Lisa Purinton, with the Department of Public Safety. I'm the Acting Legislative Liaison and the Director for the Division of Statewide Services. Thank you for hearing this bill again today. House Bill 275 is a bill that provides empowerment for victims of sexual assault. What the bill does is it requires the Department of Public Safety to implement and maintain a sex assault kit, examination kit tracking system that will allow victims the ability to log in to track the location of their sex assault exam kit at any time in the process, and to also be able to log in and see when the state crime lab has actually processed that examination kit. So that gives some empowerment back to the victims to track where that information is going. The bill requires the department to do it. The department already has this software. We have the application. We implemented it last summer, and we worked with law enforcement agencies, medical providers, advocacy groups, prosecutor's office across the state to give training on the system, how it works. And the agencies are now, it's been in use for several months now, so we're very proud of that fact. The bill also sets a requirement for timelines. The current law requires the crime lab to process the sex assault exam kits within 6 months of receiving them. It requires law enforcement agencies 30 days from the time that they receive the kit from a healthcare provider to get that information to the lab so that they can process it. And so this bill will then also add a requirement for a timeline for healthcare providers to notify law enforcement within 7 days that these kits are available for processing. So it has timelines for all parties that are processing these sex assault examination kits. So that's pretty much in a nutshell what the bill does, and available for any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Purinton. Are there any questions, Representative Mina?
Thank you, Chair Prox, through the chair. I have one question related to some of the public testimony on this bill during the last hearing. For the DNA of survivors that are collected from the sexual assault kit, is there anything that prohibits the department from utilizing that DNA for other purposes outside of processing the kit to find the assailant or whoever conducted the crime?
Thank you for the question, through the chair to Representative Mina. The information, when a kit is processed, that DNA information that is collected for the suspect DNA information, it is rolled in a national program called CODIS. And it is against the CODIS rules to enroll victim DNA information in that system. It would be considered unethical. So this would be more of a policy process. There wouldn't be anything to like physically prevent putting that in there, but that's something that the system, it's against the requirements to do that, to put that into the national database. That is strictly for suspect DNA information.
Thank you.
I can get you some more information and more detailed, but my lifeline just walked away from the crime lab. But I can certainly provide that information to you in a little bit more detail.
Thank you. I would appreciate that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Very good. Thank you, Ms. Purinton. And we have four amendments, two of which, well, let's just go through the process. Representative Ruffridge, amendment number one.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I will not be offering Amendment 1.
And Representative Ruffridge, Amendment 2.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I will not be offering Amendment 2.
Okay. And Representative Ruffridge, Amendment number 3.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I move Amendment 3.
And I object. Would you like, Mr. Representative Ruffridge, would you like to speak to your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Chair Prox. I want to be clear that I certainly fully support this bill and obviously support the department and their mission to ensure that there is both justice and clarity of the process for individuals who will be at all ends of the process for sexual examination kits. In our testimony, it was pretty clear to me that a lot of the ends of this process, both the laboratory end and the law enforcement end, are actually doing much better than what we are prescribing currently in statute. And while I understand that that has come at an extreme cost and a real effort but on the behalf of the administration and members of department leadership, I thought it would be wise to at least try to allow our statute to start continuing the downward pressure on the time that it takes to process a examination kit. And so amendment number 3 would change the line on page 2, line 3, where it says within 30 days of receiving a notification from a healthcare provider that the kit is ready to gather the evidence to 20 days. And continuing that process of just trying to say our goal is to get these kits done in the fastest time frame possible. I certainly welcome any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions from the committee? I have a related question from Ms. Perrington, if you please come forward. When I was reading about, I don't know if I want to say the national standard, but there was a federal publication, I believe, on sexual examination kits. And they have recommended even a shorter timeline, which actually the question involves if the lab gets backed up, do they prioritize? Before that, apparently some victims don't necessarily or haven't decided whether they want to pursue a criminal investigation. And I have no idea how often that happens, but does the department prioritize kits for, if you will, active investigations? Or do they just take them first come, first serve?
To the chair, for the record, Lisa Perrington, Department of Public Safety, Division of Statewide Services Director and Acting Legislative Liaison, to the chair to answer that question. I don't know that there is a priority on there. I would defer that to our crime lab investigator, and I can certainly find that information for you. It was my understanding if it's an what we call an anonymous sex assault kit where the victim has not been identified because they have not chosen to move forward in the process, those kits are not processed until that individual chooses to move forward in the criminal investigation. But for the other active cases where there's law enforcement involved and there's a criminal investigation as far as the priority, I will have to check with the lab and get that information back to you, sir.
Okay, I would appreciate that. Thank you. And I guess I really don't have any other questions. Are there any other questions about Amendment Number 3? And I will then remove my objection. Are there any other objections? And with that, Amendment Number 3 is adopted. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I move Amendment 4.
And I will object. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Amendment 4 actually continues in the same vein as Amendment 3. This one, however, dealing with the laboratory to which the kit is sent. And instead of that time frame on line 20 being 6 months for the laboratory to conduct the testing, that reduces the statutory day amount to 120 days or 4 months. So again, trying to continue that downward pressure of getting these kits resolved in a timely fashion, and hope that our statute backs up decisions that may be made by the Department of Public Safety in order to staff the lab appropriately to accomplish that task.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge. So do we have confidence that taking it down, that providing 120 days to perform that test is going to be an achievable tasking for the laboratories, such laboratories?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, during testimony on this bill, we actually heard that the time frame in the lab currently is at 90 days, and that was one of the reasons why I had initially drafted Amendment 2 at 90 days in discussion with individuals from the Department of Public Safety. It was thought to be wise to at least allow some flexibility for if the lab gets outside of that current 90-day process and set the cap just a little higher to allow for some flexibility. And so to answer your question simply, yes, I think it absolutely is possible. It's being done now. certainly want to promote that happening in the future.
Thank you for that.
Thanks. Representative Sadler, are there any other questions or comments about amendment number 4? And I would just like, I guess, to state for the record, this is a statutory limit, and I would be certain that the Department of Public Safety is going to try and process them as quickly as we can, because that is important for a number of reasons to get this done as soon as we can. But all right, with that, I remove my objection. Are there any objections to amendment number 4? Seeing none, amendment number 4 is adopted. Do we have other amendments? I don't have any. So there was a suggested amendment was emailed to us from somebody from the public. And so what I think I'll do is we'll set this bill aside and give time to think about that amendment, get it distributed out to folks, and pick this up at a future hearing. And with that, yes, we set an amendment deadline, but if you have other things that need to be considered, that's more important than a deadline. Just let us know as soon as you can. Thank you. So with that, we will move on to the last item on our agenda, which is the initial hearing of HB 298, Alcohol Warning Signs on Licensed Premises, sponsored by Representative Gray. And here to assist him is David Song. And we will also be hearing invited testimony from Dr. Janice Schofelt, Thomas Gremlin, Dr. Madeline Grant, and Dr. Tim Nami. But Representative Gray, would you please come up to the table, put yourself on record, and give us the introduction to House Bill 298.
Thank you, Chair Prox. For the record, my name is Andrew Gray, and I represent House District 20, the UMed District of Anchorage. Thank you, Chair Prox, and members of the committee for hearing the Alcoholic Beverage and Cancer Act. The bill in front of you today, House Bill 298, will inform Alaskans that Alaska can cause cancer, including colon and breast cancers. There has been broad scientific consensus for decades that the consumption of alcohol significantly increases the risk of 7 different cancers. The relationship between alcohol and cancer was first documented by the World Health Organization in 1987. In 2023, the World Health Organization issued the following statement, quote, "When it comes to alcohol consumption, there is no safe amount of alcohol that does not affect health," end quote. The 2020 American Cancer Society guidelines advise complete avoidance of alcohol specifically for cancer prevention due to an increased risk of cancer evident with consumption of less than 1 drink per day. That's the American Cancer Society guidelines for 2020. Alcohol-related cancers affect tens of thousands of Americans each year. Despite the long-standing medical fact that alcohol increases cancer risk, there has not been an accompanying change in public perception about the risks associated with alcohol consumption. Some surveys from the National Institute of Health even indicate that 10% of adults believe alcohol consumption decreases risk. This is simply not true. All alcohol is carcinogenic. The more you drink, the greater your risk. But any amount of alcohol, even a small amount, is still carcinogenic. House Bill 298 addresses this gap in public health knowledge by changing the text on a required warning sign at the point of sale. That sentence that would be added reads, "Alcohol use can cause cancer, including breast and colon cancers." I drink alcohol. I am not a teetotaler. The goal of this bill is not to restrict access to alcohol. The goal of this bill is to empower all Alaskans to make informed decisions about the products they consume. My hope is that this bill will better inform Alaskans of alcohol's cancer risk so that they can reduce their risk if they choose to, and I believe many will choose to. A decreased risk will result in a decrease in Alaska's cancer cases. This will decrease our healthcare costs, but more importantly, this bill will save Alaskan lives. My staff, David Song, will now talk through the sectional analysis and walk us through a short PowerPoint before we have our subject matter experts. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Song?
Great. For the record, David Song, staff to Representative Gray. This is a pretty simple sectional analysis. It amends AS04.21.065B to change the text on one of the signs that alcohol vendors are already required to display at the point of sale. Currently, the sign reads, warning, drinking alcoholic beverages such as beer, wine, wine coolers, and distilled spirits or smoking cigarettes can cause birth defects. And this bill would change the text to read, warning, alcohol use during pregnancy can cause birth defects. Alcohol use can cause cancer, including breast and colon cancers. Okay. So now we're going to go into a brief presentation to kind of expand upon the background that Representative Gray touched upon and talk about 298 and the issue it's trying to address. Okay. All right. So first off, it's a medical fact that there's a causal link between alcohol consumption and cancer. And this has been well established for decades. This applies to all types of alcohol, including red wine. Tens of thousands of cases of cancer can be attributed annually to alcohol consumption in North America. Alcohol consumption is the third highest modifiable risk factor for cancer. And it doesn't have to be major binge drinking that causes this risk. According to a 2017 Surgeon General's report, even moderate levels of drinking increases risk for breast cancer. And in that report, a moderate level of drinking was defined as having up to 1.5 drinks per day. Okay. So according to the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer, 60,000 cases of cancer in 2020 were attributable to alcohol consumption in North America. Of those cases, 26.3% were breast cancer, 27% were colorectal cancer, and 16.8% were liver cancer. And just for the record, March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. And also, as you can see, there were also significant numbers of cases for oral and pharyngeal cancers as a result of alcohol consumption. So one of the major issues we have with prevention is that there's a major information gap relating to alcohol consumption and cancer risk. So as of 2020, an NIH study showed that only 31.2% of U.S. adults were aware of the cancer risk for liquor consumption. Only 24.9% of U.S. adults were aware of the cancer risk for beer consumption. 20.3% of U.S. adults were aware of cancer risk for wine consumption. And as Representative Gray said, 10% of U.S. adults falsely believe that wine consumption decreases cancer risk. It does not. On the other hand, American consumers are aware of the risks when it comes to other kinds of carcinogens. So, for example, nearly 90% of Americans know that there's a link between tobacco use and cancer. And so, in other words, warning labels that connect the product with cancer do work in terms of increasing public awareness. Okay, so what does HB 298 do? It would change the text on it changes one of the signs that is required at the point of sale for alcohol from the text on the left to the text on the right. So we keep the information in the previous sign about alcohol use and birth defects and add text that says alcohol use can cause cancer, including breast and colon cancers. Yeah, so this is not a new idea. This has been implemented in other countries as well. Ireland and South Korea, for instance, have passed legislation to require cancer warning labels on alcohol containers. So here's an example of an Irish warning label, which clearly states the relationship between alcohol use and causing cancer and liver disease. And our bill doesn't go as far as Ireland's. We're just requiring a sign at the point of sale. So ultimately, this is a simple and cost-effective way to help reduce the aforementioned information gap. As you saw in your packet, we received a zero fiscal note from DCCED, and this is a pretty easy piece of legislation to implement. Vendors don't need to put up an additional sign. It just replaces one of their existing signs. So in conclusion, Alaskans deserve to be fully informed about the health risks of all the products they consume, including alcoholic beverages, and HB 298 is an easy way to provide consumers with that information. So we ask for the committee's support and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Do we have questions for Representative Gray? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I have a couple of questions, so I'll just ask a few of them. The first is through the chair to Representative Gray. When vendors have the sign that they put up in their stores, do they have to print them out themselves, or can they get that sign from the state? How does that process work?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Mina, I believe that we have the Alcohol Marijuana Control Office online, and they should be able to answer that question.
Through the chair, I'm sorry, I stepped out just for a second as the question was raised. Would you please repeat it?
Yes, through the chair, my question is related to how printing of the sign works. Do vendors of a liquor store, would they have to print them out themselves and put up the sign, or can they get the sign from the state?
We have a couple ways of doing it. First, on our new online licensing system, it's available there for them to print. We also make annual printings of the sign, and with new orders, because we need the signs, we would change the wording should the legislature enact this bill. So that's why the zero fiscal note is there. The cost is already within our budget. But we give people options.
Okay. And ma'am, would you please identify yourself for the record? I don't know that we asked you to do that.
I apologize. My name is Joan Wilson. I'm the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office.
Okay. Thank you.
May I ask another?
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, looking at the bill language, it removes in page 1, lines 6 through 8, this specifying beer, wine coolers, and distilled spirits or smoking cigarettes. Is there a reason why that language is being taken out?
Yes. Through the chair to Representative Mina. Mainly, it was to streamline this. We didn't want to have too much information, but and then there's also wider awareness of the impacts of tobacco. But we would consider it a friendly amendment if you wanted to add cigarette language back into the sign.
Let me ask one more question,
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. One more follow up. I know that through the chair, this bill is specific to cancers. I know that there's been work in this legislature in previous years about more education and awareness of fetal alcohol syndrome. I don't know if the intent of the sponsor is to strictly focus on cancer awareness or if there would be an openness to education on FASD, which there is a very direct link between alcohol usage and pregnancy.
Through the chair to Representative Mina, can you go back to the slide that shows this? That shows the can we go back like two slides to what our signage is? And so thank you. Through the chair to Representative Mina, although we're not spelling out FASD, we're mentioning that alcohol use during pregnancy can cause birth defects. Alcohol use during pregnancy leads to FASD. Again, if you wanted a friendly amendment to add FASD, I'm not sure that everyone who would see the sign would know what that meant, but we are open to that as well. And we believe that giving the pregnancy warning is indirectly addressing FASD.
Thank you. Okay. Thank
you. Representative Sumner.
Thank you. Through the chair, so you say it's settled science that any amount of alcohol increases cancer risk? Because I am troubled reading through this that moderate alcohol consumption is associated with a net decrease in all-cause mortality, and trying to mesh that up with increased cancer risk. And I worry about, you know, the potential confounding factors. And then I also think about just the vast volume of medical research that is simply false. And I look to, you know, every once in a while you'll see splashed on newspaper headlines, chocolate reduces the risk of heart disease. And then another one, chocolate increases the risk of heart disease. And I think there may be studies both ways on almost every dietary element saying that it either increases or decreases cancer risks. And so I wonder how settled this science is.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Sumner, I
Representative
yes.
Oops. Gray.
Yes, sorry.
For the record.
Yes. Representative Gray, through the chair to Representative Sumner, I'm very appreciative for that question. We have four subject matter experts about to testify. One of them will be Dr. Namy. He absolutely is the authority on this issue. But I will just point out that in 2015, there was a meta-analysis that involved 572 studies. And the results from that meta-analysis was that, I mean, I guess I can read it. I mean, it showed that there was a definite increase in risk for cancer for, and they did all the amounts for all the different cancers. So I would prefer to defer to the subject matter expert, but I'll just say that 572 study meta-analysis is very convincing.
Okay. Representative Sumner.
And through the chair, meta-analyses really do actually kind of bother me in a way. So I think if you have a large enough data set and you manipulate it properly, you could essentially get any output that you want. And what troubles me is sort of the publication bias, right? There are very few papers published that report not finding an effect. Those simply don't go to journals and get published. Mm-hmm. What is published is studies that show an effect. There's a bias to studies that found the outcome that they were looking for, essentially. So we don't know that 20 other people didn't do a meta-analysis in a slightly different way and find no effect, but did not publish. So those studies do trouble me. And I understand we can't go round random people up and give them differing amounts of alcohol and see if they develop cancer. But I guess maybe we should listen to your invited testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Through
We'll just listen.
Okay. Yes. Through the chair to Representative Sumner, I do want to defer to my subject matter experts, but I will say that the American Cancer Society guidelines is really what I'm reiterating. And so I look forward to hearing from my subject matter experts as well to answer your question.
Mr. Chairman, I have my hand up in the queue, please.
Representative Sadler and then Representative Ruffert.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Gray, I have no doubt of your good intentions. You spoke about this bill before, and my position on this bill is going to be betrayed kind of by my series of a couple questions, if I may. So just to set the rhetorical, these are some philosophical, almost rhetorical questions, but my question is, should people be allowed to take action that is known to be bad for them?
Yes.
Okay,
for the chair, to Representative Sadler, people should absolutely be able to take risks with their health if they choose to.
I'm not trying to mousetrap you, but through the chair. So the question that comes to my mind is, how much obligation does the state have to inform people of the risks of legal activities? I don't know if we need to have placards on cars or private airplanes or bicycles or roller skates to say that you can break your arm, you can die. The same philosophical arguments that would have warning signs for alcohol that might cause cancer could be applied to any of these things. And they're good intention, but the road to, I'll say, a cotton wool state could be indeed paved with good intentions. I'm not really trying to engage in a reductio ad absurdum to take the argument to its extremes, but to probe the answer to the question of what's the threshold. I've sat in this room in years past and debated the taxation on tobacco, on justification that there are public health costs to tobacco and therefore we should tax them to do that. And I don't know if in the future we're going to look back and say, when did the process begin of taxing cars for the hazards, putting placards on bicycles, et cetera, et cetera. So the question I would ask and that your bill brings to us is, what is that threshold? I have no desire to argue whether or not alcohol causes cancer or what study or to what degree or whatever, but it's just the philosophical question of how much should the state do and what the threshold is. So I don't think there's an answer to the question unless you have one, but thanks for letting me pose those questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gray.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler. I appreciate where you're coming from. I believe that a zero fiscal note proposition is not putting an undue burden on the state. And I believe that informing Alaskans of this particular risk, particularly with colon and breast cancers, which are the most common cancers associated with alcohol, I think educating them about that is important. I do believe that we have high healthcare costs in Alaska, and a zero fiscal note information campaign that might decrease our healthcare costs, I think would be worthwhile.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ruppert.
Thank you, Chair Prox, and thank you, Representative Gray, for bringing this bill forward. I actually have kind of similar questions to both of my colleagues that have already asked questions, but a little differently, and I'm actually really excited to ask the question ahead of the testifiers, because I think we're going to give them a lot of things to at least speak to. But, you know, obviously data can be, you know, there, not there. It's alcohol obviously is a substance that is not always good for people. That's we can all agree on that. Cigarettes, other tobacco products or products that are not always good for people. And, you know, there may need to be an information campaign to let people know that in certain areas. One of the areas that I maybe take issue with is why we point significantly in the direction of vices all the time. So tobacco or alcohol. It feels like if a real true public health campaign, and I feel like I'm going to sound like Michelle Obama, and it's also funny considering that I'm overweight, but is a sign at the beginning of the grocery store that says everything that is not in the produce section can lead to significant weight gain. And weight gain is actually, I think, the second leading cause of cancer. And so, or being overweight. And so I think I kind of see where Representative Sadler is coming from, which is, you know, kind of the question of, you know, why select out alcohol? You know, if we're not going to also take on some of these other things and allow people to know. I don't think people always assume, I think people know that weight gain causes diabetes, but I don't think that people understand the significant health ramifications of being overweight. So just wondering if that's something you could speak to.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, two things. And I thought of this because you're a pharmacist, but when alcohol passes through the liver, it is converted into acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde damages DNA. That is a fact. It damages DNA. So that's where we get the point that even a small amount of alcohol, once it's converted to acetaldehyde, is going to damage DNA. I sincerely believe that the majority of the American public does not know that. And so unlike, I agree with you that with being overweight, people may not know that that's a risk factor for cancer, but they certainly know that being overweight is a risk factor for other health problems. I think nowadays it's rare and far between that you find someone that really doesn't believe that smoking cigarettes could cause cancer. So I think when we think about the three risk factors, the tobacco use, being overweight, and alcohol use, I believe that the one that's least known to the public is alcohol use. And so again, to kind of reiterate what I said to Representative Sadler, I believe that this is a very low cost way of getting some of that knowledge out to the public.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so let's go on to invited testimony. I believe the first in line is Dr. Madeline Grant.
Sorry.
Oh, excuse me.
We have one in person. Dr. Janice Schufelt from Bartlett Hospital will go first, if that's okay.
Thank you for keeping me straight. Dr. Schufelt. Please put your name on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Greetings. For the record, I'm Janice Schufelt. I'm a family physician here in Juneau, and I've been practicing here since 1997. So I worked for the tribal health system for a number of years, and now I'm employed by Bartlett Hospital as a hospitalist. I also have deeper family roots here in Alaska. My mom was born in Sitka and grew up in Wrangell. Anyway, every day that I am seeing patients, I see the impact of alcohol on Alaskans in so many different ways. you know, there's no debate in the medical community about alcohol increasing the risk of cancer. This bill is supported by the Alaska Academy of Family Physicians and also the Alaska State Medical Association. I'm on the boards of both organizations. So just to give you some examples of what I see in my practice, last summer we had a patient who was unfortunately in and out of our hospital numerous times, flown to Anchorage, hospitalized there many times, and eventually he died from stomach cancer. And he was a regular consumer of alcohol, and there's a clear link between alcohol increasing the risk of stomach cancer. And his was a really memorable case because just how awful it was, you know, bleeding episodes and in and out of the hospital so many times. When I was in the clinic, I had a patient who was also in his 50s who had a sore throat, didn't get better. It turned out he had throat cancer. And again, he was a person who regularly consumed alcohol. In an especially tragic case, just within the last week, a 42-year-old man came to the hospital and died in the emergency room. He had widespread colon cancer. It had already spread throughout his body. He was getting treatment. And I think where this type of signage can be really helpful, you know, if your sibling, if your 42-year-old sibling or your 42-year-old parent died of colon cancer, I think this signage would probably catch your eye. You know, maybe it's not something you've talked with your family doctor about, like, hey, my relative died of colon cancer. What should I do to decrease my risk? But they might encounter a sign like this pointing out colon cancer. So I will leave my testimony to that, to these 3 minutes. And thank you for serving on this committee and representing Alaskans.
Okay, thank you. And next, well, do we have any questions first for Dr. Schofield? Representative Sadler. Dr. Schofield, if you could please go back.
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Schilko. And this is a question I'm not sure if your experience in public health helps you out. And it's a difficult question to ask. What is the larger public health hazard? Is it cigarettes and cancer? Is it alcohol and cancer? Is it alcohol and birth defects? I'm just trying to see, is there any kind of prioritization, gradation, or hierarchy of public health hazards for some of the vices that we're talking about here?
So through the chair to Representative Sandler, that's a very tough question. I think every pregnant woman in America knows that they shouldn't drink alcohol while they're pregnant. So I think a whole different tact needs to be for that group of people, like effective and accessible treatment programs. And as was outlined in the introduction, people really do know after years of education about tobacco increasing the risk of cancer. I think with alcohol, this is a I see it as a way to a broader topic. Like, we know that alcohol increases the risk of cancer. People can relate to that. They probably know someone, a friend or family member who's had cancer. But alcohol is just so devastating. You know, excessive use of alcohol is so devastating where I see it every day. Patients that I admit and care for. And so I personally think anything that we can do to just nudge what the norm is effective public health policy. So maybe people think, you know, a few drinks a day, no problem. But if they have it in the back of their head, well, you know, maybe it increases cancer. You know, maybe they'll sometimes have fewer than a couple drinks a day. And I think any way that public or the population as a whole, if what's accepted as normal in our culture, if that's nudged ever so slightly, it has an incredible positive impact on the population's health as a whole.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Schopelt. And next we have Dr. Madeline Grant from Anchorage Online. Dr. Grant, are you available?
I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Please put yourself on record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Dr. Madeline Grant. I'm a board-certified internist and a fellow of the American College of Physicians, which is the big internal medicine group. I've been practicing in Alaska since 1991, and I do primary care. Oh, so in primary care, people all the time to take care of their problems, but also for preventative care. Oh, and what are the big killers of most of us? Most of us are not going to get stomped by moose or struck by lightning. The big killers are cardiovascular, stroke, heart attack, and cancer. So those are the big ones. And in fact, in Alaska, cancer is the biggest killer. So I talk with people a lot about their risks. I can't think of the last time that I saw somebody who didn't know that tobacco caused cancer. But I see well-educated, informed, thoughtful people on a regular basis who don't realize the association of alcohol and cancer. Breast cancer in particular. I saw a woman this morning, in fact, 65-year-old woman in very good health, who was very afraid because her mother died of breast cancer. And she's thought about it a lot, very careful about her mammograms. She had no idea that alcohol was associated with cancer risk. 12.9% of American women are going to get breast cancer statistically. Some of us are at higher risk than others. I'm a physician. I drink alcohol, but I drink it in moderation, and I drink less since I learned this. I think that passing this bill gives people agency. It lets them make informed decisions about something, this particular aspect of health that they didn't realize. And as a busy primary care physician, me a lot of time, I don't have time to educate people about every single thing they could do for their health. Although, Representative Ruffridge, if you want to pass something for public health, please put posters up all over the place telling people to take a walk every day or get some exercise. those are my thoughts, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Dr. Grant? Thank you, Dr. Grant. Next, we have Thomas Gramillion on Teams. Spector, Food Policy, yeah. Consumer Federation of America.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can hear you. Please put your name on record and proceed with your testimony.
Thanks very much. My name is Thomas Gramillion, and I'm the Director of Food Policy at Consumer Federation of America. I'm also a proud former Alaska Supreme Court law clerk, but I'm in Washington, D.C. now. Consumer Federation of America, my organization, is a nonprofit organization established in 1968 to advance the consumer interest through research, education, and advocacy. And my interest in an alcohol cancer warning arose out of my organization, CFA's decades-long advocacy to bring alcohol labeling into alignment with other beverages and food with respect to things like calories, ingredients, and allergens, which consumers in polling voice, you know, very, very broad, overwhelming support for. And a few years ago, as I was preparing comments on a proposed update to federal alcohol labeling rules that once again ignored all of the information that consumers want to see on alcohol labels, I became aware of the link between alcohol and cancer that Representative Gray and the other testimony, you know, people giving testimony have talked about. And I also became aware of the low public awareness of the link. And frankly, I wasn't surprised that there was this low public awareness because I myself had been so ignorant of the science. And as I dug, I was very surprised at the link. And so as I researched the issue more, I learned about alcohol cancer warnings in other countries, in particular the experiment in the Yukon province of Canada, in which cancer warning labels were placed on alcoholic beverages and were associated with a statistically significant drop in sales. And I've come to the conclusion that alcohol cancer warnings are a powerful public policy tool. And it's precisely because alcohol cancer risk, on the one hand, represents such a significant health burden, and the awareness of that risk is so low. So I think, Representative Sadler, you put your finger on the key issue there. Like, if we were advocating for a warning that said alcohol may cause health problems, like the health warning on alcoholic beverage labels that's been required since 1988, I think we would have a tough argument because everyone knows that. However, the awareness of alcohol's relationship to cancer is very poorly understood. Even those that realize excessive drinking causes cancer, it's pretty unusual for someone to be cognizant of how even moderate drinking causes several types of cancer, including breast cancer. And so CFA supports federal reforms to require a cancer warning on alcoholic beverage labels, and also bills like this to raise awareness at the state level. We have a paper on our website entitled State and Local Public Policy Options for Raising Awareness of Alcohol Cancer Risk, and we make the argument for point of sale warning signs. And in particular, we make the argument that even if we accept claims that moderate drinking produces cardiovascular or other health benefits for some consumers, which is, there's a growing body of research that suggests, you know, we should be very skeptical of those claims. But even if we do accept that those claims are partially true, the cancer risk associated with moderate drinking, right? You know, one and a half drinks a day on average, that risk is large enough to outweigh the claimed benefits for many consumers. Maybe not all. Maybe certain people at a certain age, the benefits of drinking small amounts of alcohol outweigh those cancer risks. But for many consumers, that's not the case. And for those consumers, Dr. Grant mentioned agency. You know, this is about giving people information to correct maybe a decision that they wouldn't have made had they had that information. So, for example, young people, cancer is more of a risk than cardiovascular disease. Cancer causes is a bigger mortality factor than cardiovascular disease for young people. Or colon cancer survivors. There's a study that indicates often doctors don't warn colon cancer survivor patients that don't give them advice to avoid alcohol. There's a study that indicates women with a BRCA mutation may be at greater risk of alcohol-induced breast cancer. So for different consumers have different risk profiles, and this is a way to give them the information they need to make rational choices. Briefly, I also want to say that raising awareness of alcohol cancer risk, it is a good policy because the evidence indicates doing so will lower sales and lower consumption overall. And that, in turn, there's good evidence to suggest that will decrease alcohol abuse and alcohol-related harms. And then finally, I just want to point out, it's not just warning labels. These point-of-sale warning signs work. They work to reduce fetal alcohol syndrome in the 23 states and the District of Columbia where they've been required for a couple decades now. So it may seem like no one's paying attention, but they do push out the awareness over time and slowly change the mindset. So I hope Alaska can blaze the trail for other states to follow suit and help consumers make more informed choices. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Sumner.
Thank you. Through the chair, a couple questions. So it sounded like you said that the Yukon Territory adopted point of sale warning signs, and it was associated with a statistically significant reduction in sales. Was there, or did anybody check if there was a statistically significant reduction in cancer? And then my other question is, I'm looking at a number of studies here that seem to say that red wine consumption is associated with a net reduction in cancer. Now, not a big fan of medical studies in general. I think a lot of them are trash. Medical reversal is a very real thing, but I wonder if maybe these signs being so broad might have in some ways a negative effect. And so maybe if you could address those two questions. Thank you.
I don't want to be out of order. I think I respond Representative Prox through, I'm sorry, I forgot the, but to respond respectfully, the UConn study involved labels on the bottles of alcohol, which is preempted under federal law in the United States. You know, state of Alaska can't prescribe a different health warning statement on alcoholic beverage labels. It was also, the study was curtailed prematurely because of opposition from the alcohol industry. So I think it only ran 6 weeks, but it led to something like a 6% drop in sales. I don't think you could, you know, with that, those numbers that were involved in that, it would be very hard to demonstrate a drop in cancer. But the point was, you know, people saw the warnings and they changed their behavior because it is novel information for most people. And I'm sorry, I was there. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Follow up, Representative Sumner.
Thank you. Through the chair, the other question I had was that by making this blanket statement of alcohol, we seem to be ignoring, I guess, it looks like there's a lot of studies saying that red wine reduces cancer risk. So could we, by making a blanket statement, possibly be doing not a great service for the public?
Thank you. So through the chair, Dr. Namy, that's going to follow me, is the authority on this sort of thing. You know, she served on the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee and looked at all the literature out there. I can say, though, even as a lawyer and not a epidemiologist, that the evidence that red wine decreases cancer risk is. You know, thin as a sheet of paper. All alcohol, the mechanisms are very well understood, how alcohol causes cancer. There are studies that purported to show important cardiovascular benefits associated with alcohol. And since then, other studies have shown that there were a lot of confounding variables that account for those findings. There's, like you said, I believe earlier, I mean, people can manipulate data and there's publication bias but at the end of the day, we've got to, you know, go with the evidence we have and the data we have and empiricism marches its course. We know that alcohol causes cancer and that most people greatly underestimate the magnitude of that impact.
Okay. Thank you. Representative McCormick. And Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. Through the chair, this question is actually for Representative Representative Sumner. I was curious if there's actual studies that you can cite that you're seeing lots of them. If you would just put that on the record, and please confirm it's not like Franzia that put that out or something. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, you can go on Google and look it up. Here's one from the Journal of American Dental Association saying red wine may reduce oral cancer risks. Here was another one about lung cancer. I mean, you know, if you would like me to go through and compile them. Now, I will say, though, that all of these are garbage because of issues like publication bias and p-value hacking and the like. But all those things also apply to medical research, potentially, about the risks of moderate alcohol consumption. I don't think there's any question that massive consumption of alcohol certainly causes liver cancer and other issues. But moderate consumption of alcohol, it's hard to remove confounding factors like increase in smoking that may be associated with that and other lifestyle issues. And depending on how you chop that data up, you can produce any effect you want, essentially, is what my point is here.
Before we go to that, we have a chance to debate the merits. We have, I believe, Dr. Tim Nami. Do I have that correct? Are you online?
Tim Nami.
Nami, please put your self on record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Can you see my picture?
We certainly can.
I'm not a good looking man. If you couldn't, I would tell you I was, but I'm not going to lie. All right. So I'm Tim Nami. I'm a physician, and I'm currently the director of the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research. I am a U.S. citizen. I've worked for the U.S. CDC before and at Boston Medical Center. I'm a pediatrician and an internist. I'm also boarded in preventive medicine. And anyway, thanks for having me here today. I'm not really sure how it can be of most use. The one thing I wanted to address is that as an alcohol, you know, epidemiologist, I study, in addition to being a physician, there are areas that I study that are controversial scientifically, for sure. But the relationship between alcohol and cancer is not one of them. Like, that's not particularly controversial. And in fact, I think for Chair Prax and for other folks who are in attendance, I'd like to just go through that a little bit if I could. Alcohol has been recognized as a human carcinogen, a cancer-causing agent for almost four decades now, in fact, by the U.S. government as well as by WHO. And alcohol is classified as a type 1 carcinogen, which is in the same league with very few other things, including tobacco smoke and benzene, the chemical benzene that causes leukemia. And I just want to tell you a little bit about, because I know there's some science doubters in the room, which is, you know, I'm one of them. I'm a huge skeptic of everything. But to get to be a class 1 carcinogen, you have to run quite a gauntlet. You have to be able to show how ethanol and its breakdown product, acetaldehyde that's been mentioned here, can cause cancerous changes in cells in the test tube, number one. Number two, you have to have compelling studies of humans, like where you look and see, okay, this person drank X amount of alcohol and was much more likely to get cancer. And then number three, for those cancers that are thought to be effective, you have to turn around and give animals ethanol and basically induce those same cancers. So alcohol is one of a very few substances that actually meets criteria as a class one carcinogen. So that's about that. You know, I think the issue is, I think the other points have been well raised. Like, I'm not, actually my colleague was involved with the UConn study. That study did only go 6 weeks or 2 months and was not designed to show change. You can't see a change in cancer on that basis. But I mean, again, I think the issue is that when you have a pretty well-established, not a very well-established scientific relationship between alcohol consumption and cancer, and as people have mentioned, it's not well understood. Actually, it promotes consumer freedom and choice to be able to, you know, to have people be well-informed and to make their own decisions. So people who, you know, are in favor of, you know, treating people like adults, then why not give them the information? That's what I sort of believe. And that way they can make their own choices. I think that it's just interesting, going back to Thomas Grimillon's testimony, that I always like to joke with my friends that if I buy a can of peas, I know how many servings there are per container. I know the serving size. I know how many calories there are. And I know the ingredients in the can of peas. And you know, I buy a bottle of whiskey. I have no idea that there are 17 servings per container or what the serving size is. I have no idea that how many calories there are, or that ethanol has almost as many calories per ounce as fat. But in particular, I have no idea about the health warnings. In the U.S., of course, we do have the FAS warning and the thing about operating machinery or whatever it is. But yeah, I think the awareness of alcohol and cancer is low. And I think for a, you know, it's fair that people be informed. I guess that's a political perspective, not a scientific one. But I'll just end my comments there. And if I can be of any help, I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually have a question for Joan Wilson, if she's still online.
Ms. Wilson, are you still with us?
I am.
Cool. Through the chair, Ms. Wilson, how many signs do small business owners have to post now if they're an alcohol selling or serving establishment?
Well, I'm going to say three off the top of my head. One, of course, is their license. Another is the warning sign related to alcohol consumption that you're addressing now. Another is the presence of minors. If they have a permit for event, they're going to have another warning sign up. So I'd say easily 3 to 4.
Did I ask a follow-up?
Representative Fields.
Ms. Wilson, do you think it would be logistically feasible for us, maybe using this bill as a vehicle, to consolidate the number of signs that these facilities have to post so it could be, say, one sign? And maybe that sign could say, the alcohol use can cause cancer, but, you know, get the information across without a massive amount of clutter at the entrance to these businesses.
Through the chair, I'm cautious to make legislative recommendations without consultation with both the board and the commissioner. I will say streamlining information so consumers can best understand it and businesses have less cost in providing that information seems in line with the governor's priorities. However, I would really like to, if that's the course this committee would like to take, I would like to bring that idea to the governor's legislative office and see what the position might be.
Hello, Representative Field.
Through the chair, Ms. Wilson, I just appreciate you looking into that. And I don't know if it's really feasible for a sign to be readable, you know, consolidating that information to be not a whole bunch of signs, but appreciate you looking into it.
I'd be happy to do that and report back to the committee.
Very good. I have a, I guess, open question for whoever might be able to answer it. Are we perhaps diverting attention from more likely causes of something bad happening? What is the context of the risk of alcohol, for instance, to the risk of eating too much sugar on your cornflakes? Dr. Namy, do you have some insight to that?
The question is, how does it stack up to? Well, all I know is that that alcohol causes as many years of life lost as cigarettes. That it costs more in terms of economic costs because of the issues around violence and the legal and criminal justice system. So. So I think and alcohol causes, substantial fraction of cancers in the U.S. In terms of how it stacks up to sugar, it depends how much sugar you have. But with as other people have mentioned, there's only like a straight line relationship between alcohol consumption and the cancers we've been discussing. Were you looking for an exact quantification of how much the cancer risk of a sugar in Kellogg's cereal?
I don't know that we can get that exact, but just
okay.
It's a real honest question. There seems to be strong correlation between a lot of other things and a lot of other bad things. Too much sugar is not good for you. Too many French fries aren't good for you. Are we, as a public health risk, Representative Fields brought up a good point. We've got so many signs for everything. Are we diverting attention from more urgent or dire considerations?
I mean, it's a good question. I know that that in general and in Alaska specifically, because I was worked on a lot of state issues, but you know, alcohol is a leading preventable cause of death in Alaska, and I know that each and every drink that's sold in Alaska, when you subtract the costs from the tax revenue, the taxpayers are losing money on alcohol. So, so I think it's a value judgment, but I think it's one of the leading preventable or you know sort of modifiable causes of death in Alaska, and it's very costly to the state. I think that's up to you all to decide what that means and how that you know gets played out.
Okay, thank you. And please, it looks like you have something to add. And I'm sorry, I forgot your last name.
Yes, yeah, it's a tough one. It's Brimion.
We got two of them going. Brimion. I'm sorry. Please go ahead, Mr. Brimion.
I'm sorry, the doctor. I'll be brief. I just wanted to add to what Dr. Naimi said. Why I think the prospect of a warning sign in this context is so powerful is not just the magnitude of the public harm, but it's the level of awareness. You know, if you were to put sugar warnings on cereals, people's eyes would just glaze over. They know sugar is bad for them. They know eating too much sugar is bad for them. But the science on how drinking, particularly moderate drinking, contributes to cancer risk is really poorly understood. It's novel information, and it will affect people's behavior. Thanks.
Thank you. And Dr. Schofield, you're in the room. Please.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just some thoughts to respond to your question about the risks of sugar versus alcohol in relates to the risk of cancer. You know, clearly obesity also increases the risk of cancer, but I think one of the differences is that while alcohol is a known carcinogen, it's known to cause cancer at any level of drinking, no matter how moderate or small it is. Any intake at all of alcohol increases the risk of cancer. Sugar, no matter how much bad rep carbs have these days, you know, sugar is not a carcinogen. So I think it would be I don't think that putting this change in signage would divert attention from other more important. I don't think it's any less important and wouldn't be diverting attention.
And that's a valid point. If all we're talking about is changing the signs, I think we do have a more effective sign. So to that extent, I support the bill. But
I have a question.
Representative.
Thank you.
Adler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. And at the risk of kind of repeating an earlier philosophical line, and I think the question I kind of hear bubbling behind a lot of our questions is, if we were to come at the issue of labeling of consumable products and the public health implications and costs and risks just from the beginning without having any history with tobacco labeling or alcohol labeling or anything, where would we best fit, where would we best direct our efforts? What's the greatest good for the greatest achievable good for the lowest cost, because there is a cost. There's a regulatory cost, there's a financial cost, there's an attention cost. I don't know if everyone's ever opened up a medication and found five pages of two-point type in all the different counterindications and so forth. I don't read them. I just take the drugs, you know. And if there's too many warning signs, I begin to glaze over. So we have a limited window of attention. So the question I think we have to ask ourselves is, how do we best use that window of attention? I can see the sponsor reaching to the table to answer my question. So, but that's the larger question. Not that cancer is good or bad or alcohol is good or bad, causes more or less, because we can get down a rabbit hole on any individual issue. But the question is, what obligation do we have to warn the citizens of the risks of legal behavior? And
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Sadler, I'm glad that this slide has been left up this whole time, because I think our proposed sign is clearer than the sign that we currently have. And I appreciate Representative Field's suggestion of consolidating signs, but just for the record, I am not adding a sign. I am changing the existing sign to, I believe, be more clear and to define a risk that we know is real, and yet so few people know that it exists.
Okay, thank you. Representative Field.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Since we have a bunch of medical experts here, I was curious if they had thoughts about what I think have been, through the chair, rising cancer rates in America in a period of declining vehicular air pollution. And I think broadly, since the early 20th century, declining alcohol use, at least heavy alcohol use. What does the science say is the most plausible explanation for that? An increased incidence of endocrine disrupting chemicals, microplastics, like what are, in your view or the view of the literature, the most likely causes of increasing cancer rates? Thank you.
Dr. Namy.
Dr. Namy, would you like to address that, please?
Well, alcohol consumption has been going up. I don't know where that information came up. Alcohol consumption has been going up since the mid-1990s. And I don't know the relative contributions of microplastics and other things. But alcohol consumption has gone up, and the number of alcohol attributable cancers in the U.S. has gone up. Was there anything else?
We are getting a bit of field. This is a very interesting discussion, very enjoyable discussion, but we are getting a bit of field. The bill deals with replacing one sign with another, and probably should. It's getting past 4:30. Probably should focus on that and call it a day. Any other questions, comments? Representative McCormick.
Thank you, through the chair. Just a comment. I want to thank the bill sponsor for bringing this forward. I think this type of awareness is important. I'll also say, representing a community that's been ravaged by just the difficulties of alcohol consumption and what that means, I think the cancer component is just one piece of this. I'm not necessarily advocating that we add anything else on there, but I can tell you, just a few years ago, this community of Bethel is under local option. For a while, we had a package store that sold every type of beer and liquor that you could get, and we actually had to vote, or the community decided to vote that back, just because of the tremendous burden that put on public safety services. And so that's just kind of the context that I'm coming from. And so I think just raising awareness for really the dangers of alcohol is really important. And I don't see the loss in that. I just want to kind of point out kind of my frustration, I think, just with the discussion we've had here. Just been the employment of the slippery slope logical fallacy. And I think it's incredibly frustrating to hear a really good piece of legislation like be compared to like, oh, well, what are we going to do? Like ban cars? Like we're talking about something that I think is very common sense. I think passing something like this does not mean that we're just going to like ban like everything else and put signs on everything else. So I had to hear it earlier today in another committee. And so it's just frustrating. This is, I think, a fine idea. And I want to thank the bill sponsor for bringing it forward. I also appreciate the discussion we're having right now about being or scrutinizing studies. I kind of joked about Francia having a study, but I think there's some truth to that in the sense that there really are sometimes studies that are put out by big corporations, not to sound cliche, but they can really afford to doctor information and put it out there that is dishonest or misleading. You know, Coca-Cola, I'm sure, funds a lot of studies that make Coca-Cola sound good for you. But to counter that, I would just say I think the information from the studies that we have here from reputable sources that have nothing to gain in putting this information forward other than in informing the populace on good health choices to make. So again, I want to commend my colleague here for scrutinizing scrutinizing some of these studies, but then I also just have to ask, if we don't follow these studies, then what are we following? Our intuition? I mean, that's not fair. To quote Jeff Bridges, like, hey man, that's your opinion. I just really, really concerned by some of the rhetoric in this debate and just kind of dancing around, I think, just what is a very, very common sense, very topical, very timely initiative here. So I think I've said enough. Thank you.
We might not be able to cut this off. Representative Ruffage.
Oh, sorry, I'm just
I'm sorry, representatives. I knew that. We could talk about the hazard device. Yes. Yeah. Representative Summer.
Thank you, through the chair. So I guess I'd address that. I think that there's broadly acknowledged that there's a replication crisis in medical research. I don't believe that there's bad actors in the field, but like I said, there's a number of factors like publication bias, pressure to publish, and a number of other factors that go towards that. And I think there is actually a move to addressing some of those issues with pre-registration studies, journals saying that they will publish regardless of, positive or negative outcome on the study and the like, that will address some of those issues. But, and I'm not saying that the research around alcohol and cancer is wrong. I'm saying most of the published research, medical research, is actually wrong, but that may be right, But you do see many studies like saying red wine reduces cancer risk. I think those are probably mostly garbage, as most medical research is. And it yeah. Thank you.
We will give you the last word, Representative.
Thank you so much, Chair Prox and the committee, for hearing the bill today. And special thanks to my invited testifiers. I sincerely appreciate them coming today. I have never shied away from making a controversial statement. And based on Representative Sumner's comments just now, I'll just say that when there was research being done on tobacco, there was a reason why we knew that tobacco caused cancer, but we didn't find out about it for a long time. And that is because the tobacco industry did not want people to know about it, because it would depress their sales. There is a reason why we hear about the false health benefits of red wine. It gets shared on social media over and over and over again, and we see it, and people love it. And it gives them permission to go out and drink more. We don't hear about this. This, I will be frank, it will reduce sales. We heard what it did in the Yukon Territory. I'm thankful for that. The people who are not thankful for that are the alcohol industry. And so I think I'm just saying it out loud. There are folks who make a living off of this, and increased alcohol consumption is good for business, and decreased alcohol consumption is bad for business. But I believe that letting Alaskans know the truth is our job. And I hope that we have a second hearing of this bill. Thank you, Chair Prox.
Hey, thank you. I can see a comment oozing out from Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox, to the chair. I also want to thank the bill sponsor for moving this bill forward and for the invigorating philosophical and scientific discussion on this bill. I was looking at the Healthy Alaskans 2030 priority health topics. Number one, chronic disease, reduce the cancer mortality rate per 100,000 population. And I think this is a good move to help address one of our priorities for Healthy Alaskans.
All right, thank you. Any other comments on, I just forgot the number, House Bill 298. Good. With that, we will set this bill aside. I don't have a date on a hearing, so I don't have a date on a deadline, amendment deadline. But if you do have some amendments that you would like to consider, please let us know so we can get them circulated and have plenty of time to think about. And with that, we will set that aside, and the Health and Social Services Committee is adjourned at 4:40 p.m.